Lane is a practicing attorney and financial planner since 1971, is on the faculty here at the law school at Northwestern University as an adjunct professor, has authored over 30 books on legal and financial planning, and has pioneered a new tool called advocacy investing, which is an approach to socially and environmentally responsible investing.
Thank you very much. Coleman, Tim, thanks for your hospitality. I think this is an extraordinary conference, and I'm delighted to be a part of it. I've got no props. Shall I be promoting Calvert? I would be happy to. It's a very fine mutual fund company. I think that socially responsible investing can empower all of us, and I want to talk about the ways in which that can be accomplished. I should say first two things. One, I'm a tough financial guy. I'm a lawyer with all that implies. And also, I believe that socially responsible investing has been marginalized. The investment advisory community is death on socially responsible investing. I represent individuals and institutions who control wealth. And I have conversations with them about ways to deploy that wealth in a way that achieves financial objectives, but also meaningfully speaks to their individual or institutional values. And in the case of institutions, I speak to them about ways their portfolios can indeed drive mission, and doing so in a way that does not involve any investment underperformance, because if it did, I wouldn't talk to clients about it. That's the truth of the matter. Now, the reason that investment advisors are generally opposed to socially responsible investing, and I'm talking about advisors who manage money as we do, separate accounts for individuals, for institutions, is because they haven't invested the money in technology, in research, and in people to do it right. And consequently, they are fearful that their accounts are going to underperform and they're going to lose their clients. So rather than taking a leadership role, as they should, and as we have, they instead defer to their clients and say, okay, if you don't want to invest in tobacco or alcohol or munitions or whatever the controversial industry is, we won't. So socially responsible investing has largely meant systematic exclusion of controversial industries from a portfolio. We have done very comprehensive empirical research on what happens to a portfolio when you omit one industry, two industries, three industries from that portfolio. Not surprisingly, as your number of asset classes shrinks, your portfolio becomes more volatile. And volatility is a proxy for risk. So, although we can accommodate industry exclusions, and there's some very legitimate cases where we need to for certain clients that hold deeply held convictions, where we see the opportunity in socially responsible investing is not through exclusionary screening, but rather drilling down very precisely to the client's core beliefs and identifying corporate behaviors that speak to those beliefs. I'll give you an example or two. Let's suppose the client is concerned about the environment. Investors are not monolithic. They typically hold different kinds of beliefs closer or farther from them. When you're talking about an institutional investor, we're looking at the mission of the institution, what the individual trustees of that institution feel personally makes absolutely no difference. So let's suppose we're looking at a family foundation, or we're looking at a charity, or we're looking at an individual who cares deeply about the environment. We have developed the tools to work collaboratively with the clients to identify very precisely in a targeted manner which specific environmental issues are of greatest concern to the environment, of greatest concern to the investor. Are they concerned about recycling or fossil fuels or emissions? What are they concerned about? And they may be concerned about many of them, and we will rank them and we will prioritize them. But we will ferret out information that is usable against publicly available information in portfolio construction. Now, this becomes an additive process after we do the strategic and tactical asset allocation of the portfolio, after we make our economic forecasts about which industries and which sectors are likely to outperform or underperform the benchmark, and we decide where we want to skew the portfolio and where we want to impose caps by industries and sectors at various quantitative levels, and where we decide how much we're going to want to invest in a company at most. We then ensure that superimposed upon that portfolio are positive behavioral screens to make sure that our client is not backing a company whose behavior is inimical to that client's values. So the client is leading by example. The client is showing that this can be done, how to do it, and encouraging others through this leverage to follow suit as to issues which are important to them. Now, we have done, again, very serious research on this subject. And what we have concluded is that when you look at the best performers, the very best performers among companies, social and environmental behavior, and we've broken this down generally in three different categories. One is social justice, which includes two subsets, diversity and employee relations and human rights. And the second is respect for the environment. There are also other ancillary screens like community involvement, which we can talk about in the Q&A if you like. As to the most rigorous screening, we have concluded, going back through good markets and bad markets, that the very best social and environmental performers outperform the benchmark. Now, I'm not here to tell you that investing socially responsibly or environmentally responsibly is a tool to improve investment performance. That's not what this is about. What I am saying, however, is that it is reasonable to conclude that by investing in this fashion, you're not going to give anything up, and therefore, why not do it? And if you're in a position where you're trying to transmit values to your children and grandchildren along with your money, or if you're in a position to drive mission as an institution, you have an obligation to do so, it seems to me. Now, this is a dynamic process. It involves not only portfolio construction, but now on an ongoing basis, ensuring that the companies that are in the portfolio continue to deserve to be in the portfolio. We have a full-time employee whose title is Investor Advocate. She develops and enforces proxy voting guidelines that are socially and environmentally responsible, seeing to it that each company continues to deserve to be in that portfolio. We then have the ability to galvanize like-minded investors around issues of common concern by voting proxies, by initiating shareholder resolutions, getting a seat at the table, and effecting change in the boardroom. And that's what advocacy investing is about. I have a book, a little plug here, I have a book coming out on this subject early next year, published by Institutional Investor. Tentatively entitled Calculus of Conscience, Trade-Offs for Socially Responsible Investors. But I have a book coming out this week, published by Aspen Publishers on Corporate Governance. It's a treatise for lawyers who represents directors and officers of publicly held companies. And the common theme here and within our firm is transparency. We want to make sure that these companies are doing the right things for the right reasons by our clients' lights. That's what advocacy investing is all about, and I will be eager to answer any questions about it or our approach to these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, Mark. Let me open it up for questions.
Nice job.
We have a bit of time there.
would say yes. My description up there, what we do is more of our traditional SRI services, but more and more you've got, we have a growing client base of custom clients who have their own specific criteria for what they want, and they may provide us a list of companies that they have, and then ask us or tell us that there are certain issues that they do care about, and others that they'll be more flexible on. On the other end, we're also creating indexes that may include some of the companies that were excluded from other indexes, but using a weighting system so that they're much smaller in weights. Just to reassure the mainstream investors that you're not knocking out whole industries. Plus, to allow yourself to pursue engagement practices with those companies if you have holdings with them.
May I jump in on that? The mutual funds are doing a very good job and have taken a leadership role in this area. But I think candidly, a firm that manages separate accounts like ours can't speak to that issue in a very precise way. We recognize that socially responsible investors are not monolithic, and we attach no value judgment to any characterization or self-description of social responsibility. And I'll give you a specific example from our own work. We have two clients, both call themselves socially responsible. One is a pacifist. Her instructions to us were, and this happens to be an industry screen, and a negative screen, she said, "I don't want any defense contractors." Okay, fine. And then when we got to the fixed income side of the portfolio, we said, "Well, we're not going to put you in any United States securities either then, if you're a pacifist." Yeah, I guess that's right. Another client, equally passionate, also self-described socially responsible, said, "My concern is homeland security. I care about the future of my kids. Double up on defense contractors." Both of them are socially responsible. Both of them have found a home within our firm because we're able to accommodate those differences. So we don't have to have a homogenized approach of generally excluding those industries which are deemed controversial or some people don't like, because willing to do that, clients who don't care about those industries would nevertheless suffer any underperformance that is triggered by that exclusion. So we're able to match the client's objective to the portfolio in a very rifle shot way. So that's our answer to that very good question. Thank you. No, can I speak to the question of fees? Okay. You may be right about that. Our service is limited to what may generally in this room at least be regarded as larger accounts. We have a $500,000 minimum. But I should tell you that we don't charge anything extra for advocacy investing, because it's something that I feel very committed to, and we charge the same for accounts that utilize that service and those that are our regular investment advisory clients, because I think it's important that people be encouraged to do this. I think it's a very important thing for people to be thinking about and doing. But again, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And if you are a smaller retail investor, I think mutual funds are certainly the place to start with this.
And one sort of quick follow-up is that I think you can absolutely probably find a mutual fund that sort of that speaks to your taste in terms of the way that they go about their business. Most mutual fund companies do what Mark is describing, also in terms of this what they call the separate account business, but a million minimum are usually more. But I do think it is also sort of like the world of organic food, where people throw out the term socially responsible investing, and it is kind of hard to know what that means exactly. I would encourage anybody who's really interested to go to the Social Investment Forum, socialinvest.org. It's the trade association for socially responsible investing, to learn a little bit more about the industry. And also, There's also going to be a paper or study coming out on October 15th by a gentleman named Paul Hawkins, who many of you may know. He wrote the book, The Ecology of Commerce, and he co-wrote Natural Capitalism with Amory Lovins, sort of a big thinker in terms of sustainable development issues. He's actually going after the socially responsible investment industry because of this problem of a lack, a sort of an ill-defined meaning of what socially responsible investing is. And essentially what he's trying to do is separate the more socially responsible from the less socially responsible. And so again, it, just like with any industry, you're going to have a certain level of marketing and advertising that will sort of obscure, that will seek to obscure the differences between companies that are really proactive in terms of what they're doing in terms of social responsibility and those that it's where it's more of a communications tool.
Okay, thank you.
I'll be happy to do that. I'll give you two answers to the question. One is we maintain current return numbers, which we benchmark against whatever the client wants us to benchmark against. Typically, it'll be the S&P 500, but it can be any benchmark you like, and we track all of them. And our performance tends to be significantly above all benchmarks. More precisely, with respect to the advocacy investing approach, a study that we recently concluded for the period January 95 through the end of last year, and I'll look at a cheat sheet here to tell you precisely, the Russell 3000, which was the benchmark used within that specific study, delivered 13.05% per year. We looked at the stocks within the Russell at various levels of rigorousness as against each of our behavioral screens. So we back-tested over that period. And the best social justice performers, that is, the companies applying the highest level of rigorousness, delivered 14.62% as against the 13.05 benchmark. And the best environmental performers delivered 15.58% as against the 13.05. So looking at this both from the rear view window and in terms of our current performance, in each case, this kind of screening is indeed beneficial. Now, if I can elaborate on this for a moment, I think it's important to understand. When companies are socially responsible, there is indeed a cost to that responsibility. I don't want to give the Pollyannish impression that by doing this automatically, you're going to outperform your peers. The question then becomes, is this cost an expense that's sunk, or is this an investment that has some kind of a return when a company is a good social or environmental performer? And there is academic research that is instructive on this point. And I'll give you the case of two cohorts of companies that suffered environmental hazards where they had no legal obligation to remediate. One group of companies, nevertheless, on a voluntary basis, did remediate the environmental hazards. The other elected to deploy its capital in other places and did not remediate. The companies that did remediate were perceived by their lenders to be more creditworthy. Their cost of capital went down, the return on equity went up, and their stock performance over time was better than that of the cohort that did not remediate. Now, you can make the same kind of an analysis with respect to companies that are good to other kinds of stakeholders as well. The companies that are sensitive to the needs of their employees have less turnover, lower recruitment costs, greater longevity, greater productivity out of their employees. Just intuitively, one might assume that. Similarly, the companies that have safer products, care about their customers, are likely to have greater strength in their brands, greater customer loyalty, for example. companies that care about their communities are likely to get a better reception when they need a zoning change, for example. So the companies that are more enlightened, the companies that are more progressive, make these kinds of decisions, and they're likely to demonstrate greater economic performance as a result of them. So even though these decisions have a cost, in our view, and the evidence seems to bear this out fairly consistently, that cost is more than recovered in terms of the way they are perceived by their stakeholders and ultimately in terms of the performance of the company with respect to profitability and in terms of stock price.
Sure, I'll just say that our flagship index, the Domini Social 400, is benchmarked on the S&P 500. Started in 1990 as an example of or a benchmark for socially responsible investing, and to prove to the wider investment community that give a track record to socially responsible investing, to give the wider investing community an idea of how well it performed, and it has outperformed the S&P over first 14-15 years, although if you look at some smaller time increments, it underperforms at certain points. Our newer index is based on the Russell 3000, Russell 1. We have a large cap index on Russell 1000, and then a broad called broad market social index benchmarked on the Russell 3. Those have been those have only been tracking the company since 2001, so there's less of a track record, and I guess just to be truthful, we've underperformed, but hopefully time will bear it out.
Just a very short answer to your question. We just benchmark to mainstream, so if it's a large cap fund, we'll probably benchmark to the S&P 500, or if it's a smaller cap or a bond fund, it's just whatever the appropriate sort of benchmark standard is what we typically use. And just, excuse me, one more point. We count actually in Domini also. We have indices. We would love it if other mutual fund companies would benchmark against our indices. But it's a problem in that, you know, nobody wants to be, you want to be compared to the mainstream financial performers. And in order to be able to do that, you really have to benchmark yourself against the standard benchmarks. Essentially asking in terms of interweaving competitive returns with a philanthropic effort, is that sort of the... basically, I do think that community investing seeks to do that. It's certainly a growing aspect of socially responsible investing. And so what the social investment forum is essentially encouraging mutual fund companies to commit between 1% and 5% of their assets to community investing. And everybody sort of sets their own community investing goals, however they may. At Calvert, we allocate our community investing funds to three or four areas, like affordable housing, microcredits, small business loans, and I can never remember all four whenever I'm put on the spot. So we allocate the funds both domestically and internationally, and I think we've committed about $19 million sort of in that way. You can also, there are also certain social giving mechanisms through foundations and whatnot that you can sort of set up your own personal foundation or whatever, but that's more of a giving as opposed to sort of achieving returns. The other thing that investors can do is you can certainly seek to invest in proactive companies themselves. There aren't a lot of sector funds that just try to invest in pure, you know, organic foods and renewable energy. I mean, those are very, very risky investments, and so you don't see a lot of traditional investment products, sector funds, that'll just allow you to go in and invest in those types of companies. And again, so Calder, we offer a blended way of doing that, where again, you give us $100, we take $1, we give it to our venture capital people, and they only invest in companies like Dragonfly Media, which is basically a sort of progressive alternative media organization. They publish journals on yoga and hiking and whatnot, and a company called AgriQuest, which they basically are a biopesticide company. And so their mandate is to only invest in those environmentally or socially responsible startups, and then whenever they exit through a merger or through an IPO, Calvert recoups the money and the shareholders benefit that way.
Interestingly enough, we've found that a lot of charitable organizations or socially minded foundations are very conservative on their investments, and they cling to the fiduciary responsibility that they have, and they've been very slow to respond. We thought, hey, here's an instant connection here, but it's been a hard nut to crack. But you are seeing some baby steps. The Sierra Club has taken some of its endowment, and they've opened a new mutual fund themselves. So it is happening, but we'd like to see it happen faster.
I would make the argument off your point that a fiduciary of a nonprofit or family foundation or charity has indeed an obligation to manage assets that are in furtherance of the mission of the institution. Otherwise, you may inadvertently be backing companies that act in opposition to that mission. Plus, there is a foregone opportunity which should be exploited to take your passive assets and use them to drive that mission, so that until such time as distributions are made to other organizations, or until such time as interest, dividends, and capital gains are bled off programmatically, the passive corpus should in fact be backing those companies whose behaviors are compatible with the mission of the organization or the values of the family that created the family foundation. We find there's almost a direct correlation between charitably minded individuals and socially responsible individuals, and there are all kinds of techniques to meld the two. There is, for example, a recent private letter ruling issued by the Internal Revenue Service, which permits donors to take an immediate tax deduction on contributions to charities, notwithstanding the fact that they are continuing to direct the investment management of those funds. So, for example, if someone has the intention of contributing $1 million 5 years from now to a charity, but instead can be persuaded to contribute $600,000 today, the charity gets that money now, and in the interim, that money grows under the tax-exempt umbrella of the charity, so it grows that much faster, works that much harder. Yet the individual can ensure that that money is managed in a way that is supportive of the appropriate values from the donor's perspective. So there are lots of different ways of mixing and matching. Indeed, advocacy investing was grown not within our investment advisory firm, but within our law firm in the first place. When we were doing estate planning for a prominent Chicago family, and we put together a dynasty trust that had various kinds of incentives and disincentives for various behaviors over the generations, I broached the subject, well, how about the composition of the assets of that trust? Shouldn't those also speak to your values and let your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and generations yet unborn know who you were as a person? And that's where advocacy investing was born. So thank you for a good question.
It seems that a lot of it, my original question was, it seems that a lot of agencies are based on things that don't necessarily consider external costs, such as the increase in traffic congestion, pollution, population, or anything like that. So, going back to that point of trying to change the rules of the game, is it possible for them, is there any kind of movement to develop agencies that take into consideration the external costs?
chance to shorten it up. I'm not sure I can restate it very well for you.
Can I?
Do you want to take a shot?
Yeah, you're asking if we can do more to answer questions about external costs and address those external costs in our index work. Well, first of all, we think that the criteria that we operate under now are some of the important external costs. Certainly, the environment, hazardous waste sites, TRI emissions. It's hard often to quantify the impacts of those, and the policy of quantifying impacts is still nascent, unfortunately. Yes, there are a series of refinements of external costs that you could go nuts on. But as far as practical day-to-day ratings of companies, unless you have a client that's willing to pay you a lot of money to examine, say, traffic studies, or we have to stick to our general regimen or general list of issues. On the issue of other benchmarks, you can take existing indexes and slice them different ways. Say you want to compare energy companies or utilities within an index. You compare them against their peers. Actually, that's probably a bad example, because a lot of times you have to lower the bar if you're dealing with utilities or energy companies, because more often than not, it's you're measuring between who's less of a hazard than who's more of a hazard. There are a number of different ways that you can create a slice of a different, or slice the pie differently. One way that a progressive way that we're looking into now is renewable energy companies, along with those companies that may not necessarily be known as renewable energy companies, but nevertheless are practicing efficiency measures. Maybe it's a company that builds a super green building headquarters, or a company that is buying the hybrid motors to put in their UPS is doing a lot on that, using hybrid trucks and alternative fuel trucks. So it's just an example of a different benchmark.
The answer to your question is no. I'm afraid there's just not enough information. One of Calvert's areas in which we're most active in terms of shareholder advocacy is transparency and reporting. It obviously makes our job and your job as an investor much easier if you can go and read a sustainability report from McDonald's, for example, and then you can go to Ford and you can read a sustainability report that's designed in the same format as the one from Ford. And basically, there is an initiative called the Global Reporting Initiative, and we're big backers of the Global Reporting Initiative. Our Director of Social Research is on the advisory committee for GRI, and essentially that is the ultimate purpose, is to sort of move the entire bar up in terms of information. Unfortunately, it's pretty pathetic, unfortunately, especially with American companies, in terms of just understanding the true impact of their operations. It's an imperfect science, unfortunately. We filed 13 resolutions with companies this year asking them to publish sustainability reports in accordance with the Global Reporting Initiative, and you do see some big companies that are moving in this direction, like Ford and McDonald's, not plugging their products, but I think the more companies that embrace transparency, just the better we'll all be off.
Questions? Yes.
I think basically you have some companies that are so far ahead of the curve that I do think that they will probably in general have a positive influence on their peers, especially if their stock price sort of follows their sustainability performance. And unfortunately, with Interface, it's just not necessarily been the case. There's no definitive regression analysis, unfortunately, that sort of pinpoints that sustainability variable as being the variable that results in outperformance. And so we'll never get that. If that existed, Wall Street would have figured it out by now, and everybody would be using that in their analysis. But I do think, in general, you do have these first movers that can influence an Interface. Probably not as much of an influencer as maybe a company like Ford, but nevertheless, anytime somebody takes one of those really strong leadership positions, especially if their financial performance is good, I tend to think that the other companies will tend to rise up and try to meet the challenge as well.
Question of my own, which has to do with this problem of the two kinds of investors. Investors who are interested in getting a good return on socially responsible companies, and others that have a more activist kind of agenda. And I think that you talked about it a little bit, but these are people who are interested in targeting companies who may not actually be acting responsibly and trying to get them to change behavior. Can you talk a little bit about that? What kinds of... let me add another wrinkle to that. If you're interested in influencing companies through the stockholder resolutions and that sorts of things, and now you're dealing with a mutual fund, how do you ascertain what it is your clients would like you to do? Do you have some mechanism for getting feedback? But it's probably less of a problem with Mark, because you're dealing with clients individually. You just ask them. Right, but if so let me direct that to Paul and or to David and Andrew.
If I could, while I'm thinking about it, I've got two colleagues here, and they have some materials on Calvert. I'd like to just David Fullen and Brian Hardy. And the reason I'm thinking of this story is because David, I listened in on a call that he got. Calvert filed two shareholder resolutions asking companies to include sexual orientation in their equal employment opportunity policies. We wrote an article on our quarterly newsletter, went out to all of our shareholders, and David got a call from a conservative individual investor in the Midwest who basically just does not want to support gay rights. And he handled the call quite eloquently, but it is a problem that we face in general. I think the fairest thing you can do, Tim, is to just to be transparent about what you're doing. At our website, we list all of the shareholder resolutions that we file. We filed 34 last year, so you can actually go and see. Yeah, I like these issues that they're sort of focusing on, so I'm actually going to make my investment decision based on the company shareholder advocacy perspective. But it is a fine line, and I would say that social investing is about it's about pragmatism and trade-offs, and shareholder advocacy does allow you to possibly engage in a company who you wouldn't ordinarily want to invest in, so that you can just engage them. One of the stories that I always like to tell is with Weyerhaeuser. We invested in Weyerhaeuser. It was kind of a big deal, timber company, not necessarily with the most pristine reputation. We got a call from an irate shareholder. Well, he was actually a broker, and he had an irate client who said, "I can't believe Calvert, they just sold out. They sold down the river. I want you to sell all of your Calvert shares, all my Calvert shares." So, our social analyst who said, "Look, sir, we appreciate your insight here. We're just 15 analysts, and we don't have money to fly out and visit Weyerhaeuser. We have to do what we can do with the information that's available. But would you mind getting your client on the phone so he can tell us what it is exactly that bothers him?" And it turns out, had actually been an employee with Weyerhaeuser, and he voiced some of his concerns, again, thinking that Weyerhaeuser was involving greenwashing and misleading the general public in terms of their environmental activities. We ended up sort of, in part based on our conversations with him, filing a shareholder resolution with them, asking them, again, to protect old growth forests. And so it can be a way, I think, for shareholders to kind of feel like they get a megaphone, big megaphone, and that they're able to influence companies in a way that they ordinarily wouldn't be able to.
You talked originally about these two classes of investors, the ones that are the more traditional principled ones versus the ones that are, you know, weight the financial performance equally. And we find ourselves kind of caught in that tension. In my job day to day as a researcher, I'm told not to consider the financial, and it barely comes into our index committee decisions, although it's in the back of our minds, because, you know, if you have a whole bunch of great small cap companies, it's not going to do as much as one good large cap company. But it's a tension, I say, we're caught in, because the market is heading that way, and to survive in the market, you have to speak the financial languages and talk in terms of risks and opportunities. And while we're doing that, you know, at the same time, I note that you know, a lot of the companies that we ding because of a human rights controversy, it may be an isolated one, will have no bearing on the company's financial returns or their long-term performance. But it's something that, you know, as a company and as an index committee, we have to take a stand on for any number of reasons. So there's still a divide there that we have to figure out how to cross. Most of our feedback from our clients comes on client calls, and on the other end, a lot of problem is a lot of our clients just want us to handle it. They're not interested in how it works. They just want to know what we say about whether our company is good or bad.
Are there any other questions? Maybe Mark,
it
looked like you had something. Did you have something you wanted to add?
I always have something to add. From our perspective, we believe that voting one's proxies obviously is a legal right for the socially responsible investor. We deem it a duty. And we have developed, as I indicated in my brief presentation, we've developed proxy voting guidelines, which obviously we depart from on a case-by-case basis based on client instructions. But we've made an assumption, so that our firm isn't schizophrenic, that even though a client may be particularly interested in the environment with respect to other socially responsible issues, our proxy voting guidelines will take what I'll call the enlightened point of view, the socially responsible point of view. So that's our default voting posture as to all issues. And obviously that gets trumped where a client has a different point of view, and we obviously vote the proxies of our clients as a fiduciary, which we are. But we think this is a very important piece of the puzzle, because this then allows us really to bring clients together who share concerns, and we are able to put together some very potent voting blocks, get a seat at the table, and seek to effect change in the boardroom. And this is something that I think we share with the mutual fund firms, this kind of opportunity really to consolidate power bases and really do so in a way that is meaningful in terms of ultimate decisions at the corporate level. So I think this is a very important part of our conversation. Thank you.
If I may just add one more point, Tim. I think to handle these somewhat sensitive issues at times, I think that the way that is the most honest way, I think, to address it with investors is to tell them that what we typically do is to reduce risk. We're trying to reduce our exposure to risk. And if a company, again, is possibly discriminating on an issue like sexual orientation, that there's a risk from lawsuits and whatnot that we as an investor may be affected. And so I think that most investors are motivated by, in part, that reduction of risk. And so I think that's one of the other ways that we sort of try to tell investors that, hey, you might not agree with us on this point, but nevertheless, that's why we're doing it. So.
Okay. I think we're just about out of time here. On behalf of Goldman, I'd like to thank our panelists, Mark, Andrew, and David, for giving great presentations, and everybody here for wonderful questions. And I'll give Goldman a chance to get the last word.
Okay. Thank you. That was a great panel. And I have a couple of logistical things. The special interest lunches are all filled out.